I'm Brittany Harden-Tengue, a senior manager with KPMG, and I am fascinated by the practice of transfer pricing and its impact on the global market. Join me each episode as I explore the transfer pricing world with specialists who will explain the ins and outs of this niche practice where tax meets economics. Well, it's here, the one big beautiful bill, which we are now calling OB3, and we are here to talk specifically about how this is going to impact transfer pricing for our U.S. and international taxpayers. I am very fortunate to be joined by Marissa Renson, an International Tax Managing Director.
Excited to be here.
And Thomas Betke, a Transfer Pricing Senior Manager.
Delighted to be here. Thanks, Brittany.
Thank you. Both in our WNT Washington National Tax Practice and both located in Washington, D.C. Without further ado, let's get into it. Marissa, will you just give us a general overview and introduction for any of our listeners who may be catching up on this?
Sure. And if you'll indulge me a little bit, I'm going to go back in time just to kind of explain how we got to where we are. Going way back to the earliest days of the Trump administration, and really even further back to the campaign trail, there were a couple of priorities that were particularly relevant for taxation of multinational companies. The first of these was the current administration has made a priority of fighting back against what it views as threats to tax sovereignty. And the second, the president vowed to take the temporary tax cuts that were introduced back in the first round of his administration, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, and make those permanent. Starting with that first priority, the main focus has been on how Pillar 2 relates to U.S. multinationals. The U.S. view is that the application of Pillar 2 to entities within the U.S. tax net is a threat to U.S. tax sovereignty. The current view in the U.S. Treasury Department and the administration is that if a U.S. company is subject to tax in the United States, or if its subsidiaries are taxed in the United States through the CFC regime, then Pillar 2 should not apply in any respect. The ask is that Pillar 2 would recognize the U.S. tax system is robust enough to prevent any tax avoidance for any entities within its scope. In other words, wherever the U.S. has taxing rights, its taxation should be treated as sufficient to just turn off Pillar 2. What does that actually mean as far as Pillar 2 and the U.S. tax system working together? There's three taxing provisions that apply under the Pillar 2 rules. First, the local taxing country has the right to impose a domestic minimum top-up tax. That gets first priority. And really, this is just a corporate income tax, but it is aligned with the Pillar 2 rules. Then the next taxing right order of priority is the income inclusion rule, or IIR, and that allows a country to impose tax with respect to income earned by subsidiary jurisdictions. Then third, there is the under tax profits rule, or UTPR, that allows a country to impose a tax with respect to any low tax profits anywhere in the controlled group of one of its multinationals, and that gets third priority. The U.S. position is that those second and third provisions, the IIR and UTPR, should not apply to any U.S. corporation or any wholly owned foreign subsidiary of that U.S. corporation. Our Treasury representatives at the Inclusive Framework, which is where the details of Pillar 2 rules are negotiated, they've been advocating for this position, but as you can imagine, the rest of the world was not particularly excited about this U.S. view of the world. That brings us back to the second priority of the administration, which is what we're going to focus on today, making the temporary tax cuts in the TCJA permanent and what ultimately became OB3. Since the beginning of the year, we saw a handful of proposals, often just supported by a few members of Congress, but these would tinker with the TCJA rules or propose retaliatory measures aimed at countries that would apply Pillar 2 to companies within the U.S. tax net. Then in May, the House Ways and Means Committee released legislative text for a tax bill entitled the One Big Beautiful Bill, which, as Brittany noted, we've been calling OB3. It's a little bit less of a mouthful. For about 2 months, we saw a number of iterations of this OB3 legislation. And importantly, each of these proposals that came from the House and then the first one that came from the Senate included these retaliatory measures. And these are really designed to penalize companies and jurisdictions that had enacted laws that the administration viewed as threatening to our U.S. tax sovereignty, such as the UTPR under Pillar 2. And now that takes us to June 26th, when the Treasury Department announced that it had reached a deal with a group of seven countries known as the G7. And this deal would exclude U.S. companies from Pillar 2 taxes in exchange for the removal of any retaliatory measures from our tax legislation. And the G7 later followed up with a statement confirming that an agreement had indeed been reached. So now, how does this all tie to our tax legislation? After this announcement, Congress worked out the last details of the bill, including removing those retaliatory measures. And then on July 4th, the president signed OB3 into law. We're still waiting to see exactly what the OECD will come back with to fulfill its side of the deal, and maybe a few months before we see anything setting out specific provisions. However, we do expect that the result will be that neither U.S. corporations nor any wholly owned foreign subsidiaries will be subject to another country's UTPR or IAR. Importantly, this does not turn off the right of countries to adopt their own local measures, again, what we refer to as a QDMTT or Qualified Domestic Minimum Top-Up Tax. So companies can't just forget about Pillar 2 altogether, but a large part of the compliance and tax liability should be relieved by this upcoming agreement.
Thank you. That is a fantastic overview and really does walk through a lot of the motivations and the timing.
There was another aspect we should talk about, BEAT, which is an acronym for Base Erosion and Anti-Abuse Tax.
The only change to BEAT relative to current law that actually made it into the final OB3 legislation was a permanent rate change to 10.5%. That's above the old BEAT rate for most taxpayers, which had been 10%, but it's also below the 12.5% rate that had been slated to come into effect beginning in 2026. On the whole, BEAT has slightly more bite than it has had in the past, but when viewed against what would have happened without OB3, it's actually a positive change.
For taxpayers that were already looking at their BEAT planning, this is something that still have free rein to do so. There were some other things that were impacted in the bill. In order to understand that, I think we, again, need to take a step back. Marissa, will you talk about FIDI and GILTI, but let's start with FIDI.
Under current law, FIDI refers to the deduction for foreign-derived intangible income. This is a deduction that's available to U.S. corporations, and it produces an effective tax rate on eligible income potentially as low as 13.8%. The deduction is based on net income from exporting goods, exploiting IP, or providing services to foreign markets. There's a couple important things I want to highlight here. One is that the rules determine intangible income formulaically by reducing the income that's eligible for the deduction by a percentage of the taxpayer's depreciable assets. This is a deemed tangible return, again, just mathematical, and that's a reduction in the amount that's available for the deduction. And that means that most taxpayers can't actually get down to an effective tax rate and qualifying income at the 13.8%. It's usually something higher because of that deemed tangible return. OB3 made a few changes to the FIDI rules that generally make it a lot more favorable. And I'm going to highlight the most relevant ones here. And all of these start to kick in starting in 2026. First, OB3 reduced the deduction slightly so that now it's designed to produce an effective tax rate on eligible income of 14%, again, rather than the 13.8% under current law, and it makes that rate permanent. Now, this sounds a little bit unfavorable here, but absent legislative action, the tax rate in FIDI was scheduled to go up to 16.4% permanently starting in 2026. So overall, the rate change can be viewed as a net positive for taxpayers. And again, making it permanent adds some stability to the system. Second major change is that the deduction eliminated that carve out for deemed tangible income. Now, the deduction is just based on net income from eligible transactions. This results in another name change, a new acronym to focus on. So the deduction will now be referred to as foreign-derived deduction eligible income, or FIDE. The third major change is that in calculating FIDE, this is a net number based on net income from qualifying transactions. But now, in performing that calculation, taxpayers will no longer need to reduce gross foreign-derived income by interest or research expenditures. This is a really big deal. When you put all these changes together, these are very favorable changes, and particularly for companies with a lot of depreciable assets, interest or research expenses, this is going to be a pretty big game changer.
The transition from FIDI to FIDE. We've joked that it sounds like FIDI went and studied abroad for a semester and has now come back and gotten a lot more sophisticated.
Yes.
Let's talk about GILTI.
I'm just going to level set to what the basic building blocks of GILTI are, and then we'll go through what changed. At a high level, under current law, the tax on GILTI, or Global Intangible Low Tax Income, is a tax on earnings earned by a controlled foreign corporation, or CFC, that wouldn't otherwise be taxed by our Subpart F regime. This is a refresher. The Subpart F rules tend to target passive income or income without sufficient nexus to the CFC's country of incorporation and tax that income at the regular corporate income tax rate of 21%. but doesn't apply to what we might think of as more active income. And that's what's picked up under the GILTI regime. Under current law, a U.S. shareholder of a CFC is taxed as GILTI at a rate of 10.5%, a little bit lower than the FDII rate. And the GILTI is the sum of a CFC's net tested income, and it's also reduced by a deemed return on tangible property, similar to what we saw for FDII, except that here, in the GILTI context, the deemed tangible return is actually helpful in that it reduces the amount of intangible income that's subject to tax. There are also a few special rules regarding the foreign tax credits related to GILTI. I'll spare you all the math, but the way it works out is that under current law, the GILTI regime is intended to produce a global effective tax rate on GILTI of about 13 1/8, same rate we have on FDII, when you factor in foreign taxes that are not relieved by the foreign tax credit. Although in practice, again, you could have a higher effective tax rate as a result of the way that our rules treat interest expense in particular and how that limits the extent to which you can take foreign tax credits for foreign taxes paid. In practice, the effective tax rate was often higher than that target 13 1/8%. The changes to GILTI and OB3 also largely mirror the changes we saw in FDII. The first change is that it eliminates that deemed tangible return in determining GILTI. That's actually a taxpayer unfavorable change, but there are some other changes that will offset that negative impact. OB3 would increase the global effective tax rate to 14% and make that permanent. Again, an unfavorable change, but the rate would have been even higher under current law, so I think we can call it a taxpayer win. And the third one is that it modifies the expense allocation rules in a taxpayer-favorable way that should allow taxpayers to really get that global effective tax rate at 14% and not a higher rate due to non-creditable taxes, which was one of the consequences of allocating interest when coming up with their foreign tax credit limitation. Overall, the changes here are a mixed bag. They go in both directions, but at the end of the day, it's largely going to be a wash for taxpayers and maybe favorable for taxpayers that were paying a lot of foreign taxes on GILTI for which they couldn't take a credit.
That is going to be a very welcome change for certain taxpayers. But as with any change that is made to tax policy, there are going to be winners and losers depending on industry, footprint, et cetera, et cetera. That was a really helpful overview. Thank you, Marissa. For transfer pricing specifically in light of OB3, IP planning and cost sharing arrangements are an area that are particularly interesting.
Absolutely. And I just want to really stress, Brittany, how big of a deal this is in the transfer pricing space, especially the changes to FDII that we're seeing with OB3. It is very easy to get lost in the weeds with this stuff. And to some extent, it's important and even necessary to be in the weeds. One of the big takeaways that we all learned from the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act remains true with OB3 is that modeling is really, really crucial to understanding what effect a change is actually going to have on a company's tax position in a real life situation. And if we look at this from a 30,000 foot level, what we see is something that's really interesting. The non-allocation of R&D expense and interest expense to FDII under OB3 can, in a lot of cases, actually take that 14% nominal rate down to a single-digit effective rate. And so how do you generate FDII? One of the ways to do that is to charge foreign affiliates for the use of IP that's owned in the U.S. And when you think about it in this context, assuming that the G7 agreement becomes broadly applicable so that you have a side-by-side system and the U.S. regime exists alongside but not impacted by Pillar 2, the U.S. suddenly begins to look vastly more attractive as a jurisdiction to own IP in compared to, in some cases, pretty much anywhere else. An area where we're seeing a lot of interest is in revisiting historical IP arrangements, rethinking what makes sense in a post-OB3 environment. And that doesn't necessarily have to involve moving IP, although it can, it often will. Rethinking CSAs is something that is certainly on a number of taxpayers' minds right now. It can also be as simple as changing the structure that you use to charge for making that IP available, even without transferring it between jurisdictions. Another big area that people are focused on right now is services, especially high-value services. The U.S. has an incredible talent pool. So many companies have senior leadership here. So many companies have subject matter experts here. The questions that come up are, is all of that value being captured? Is it being benchmarked appropriately? Are there new structures that can be put in place to really access the full benefit of those high value services that are being performed in the U.S.? There's really a lot here that's exciting to think about.
I love the way you put that, because it's very common, especially for a U.S. headquartered multinational that developed all the IP, slowly growing overseas. Let's say it's a software as a service company where they've got sales and marketing or software distribution subs all over the world. A lot of times we don't necessarily think about the fact that they are using IP.
This may be an opportunity for people to get more granular, and modeling is going to continue to be very crucial. Anything else that we should be thinking about?
It may be easy to get carried away with some of the excitement here around FIDI, but it's important to remember there's a lot of work that transfer pricing is going to need to do around OB3 outside of the FIDI context as well. For example, OB3 made some interesting changes to the Section 163J interest limitation. Where a company is doing or thinking about doing a debt restructuring, that's somewhere that transfer pricing is going to need to be at the table. Then there are some of the transfer pricing angles that have been around since the TCJA, and one of those is the SCM exception to BEAT, which now has a slightly boosted benefit due to that 0.5% increase in the BEAT rate. Coincidentally, the IRS put out a chief counsel memo in mid-July that confirms that the taxpayer does not actually need to elect the services cost method in order to qualify for the SCM exception. That was always pretty clear from the statute and the regs, but it never hurts to have confirmation that the IRS agrees with you.
Absolutely. It is nice to have it codified. And for those who are not familiar, the costs associated with certain low margin services, for example, back office support or other low value added activities, can generally be excluded from the BEAT calculation. This is the services cost exception for BEAT, which is slightly different than the SCM, which we use for traditional transfer pricing for intercompany services. But that's a whole other conversation we can have some other time. Any final thoughts that you have before we close out this episode?
It's going to be really important for companies to do the modeling. There are too many changes to discuss all in one episode. A lot of moving parts here. I really recommend that companies model out these changes and give some thought to how this impacts them.
I could not agree more. There's a lot here that's really interesting for transfer pricing, but you have to do the modeling to understand if it's actually going to benefit you.
Absolutely. And with that, we will keep our nose to the grindstone and keep figuring out how we can best help folks as we go into this brave new world. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for joining me on this adventure in transfer pricing. See you next time.